Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's clinical focus is on the subject of anxiety and why do we pick anxiety as an appropriate subject for our clinical focus. Well, it turns out that anxiety is actually one of the most prevalent problems that doctors confront in their medical practices. And whether it's a true medical problem that is accompanied by some level of anxiety or whether just pure and simple anxiety, this is a big category. In fact, I once consulted for a vitamin company, and they asked me in as a practitioner to inform them of, you know, what's out there. What are people interested in getting treated for? Is it cardiovascular disease? Is it cancer? And I had to answer anxiety, because this is a very, very common complaint. And, you may say, well, gee, that's not the appropriate province for complementary and alternative medicine. Anxiety is treated by psychiatrists with medications or by psychologists with appropriate psychotherapy, talk therapy. But there's a big, big role for the use of complementary integrative practices in the treatment and support of patients suffering from anxiety. And that is actually the theme of an article that I wrote for Mind Body Green. It was a very, very popular article. It got literally thousands of hits and lots of Facebook likes, and lots of people posted it on Twitter. You can find it at Mind Body Green. If you Google Mind Body Green, Hoffman, Natural Treatments for Anxiety. And I also have posted it at drhoffman.com. It's a case study of a patient who came to see me suffering from pretty severe anxiety. But it could have been actually any one of a number of patients that I've seen over the years who responded beautifully to natural treatment of anxiety, did not require anti-anxiety medication. So what's the problem with anti-anxiety medication? Why would there be any concerns about the use of anti-anxiety drugs? Well, actually, anti-anxiety drugs can provide relief to patients suffering from anxiety. And in fact, I'm not completely averse to prescribing them. Typically, patients with anxiety will receive what's called a benzodiazepine, a prescription for something like Xanax or Ativan. These are popular anti-anxiety medications. Unfortunately, these medications, while they do quell anxiety, they're quite addictive, and patients habituate themselves to them so that it may require higher and higher doses of these medications to achieve similar results ultimately. And therefore, we often see patients who have been overprescribed these medications. I can recall several patients who were assured, oh, there's no problem with these medications, and then they end up hooked on very high doses of anti-anxiety medication. And of course, one of the beauties of these medications from the standpoint of the pharmaceutical companies is that it's very hard for a patient to tell whether they really need the medications, because the symptoms of anxiety are virtually identical to the symptoms of medication withdrawal. So patients will try to get off these medications. They'll feel extremely jumpy, anxious, their heart will race, they'll have bodily symptoms like panic attacks. And these symptoms may actually be not associated with some underlying anxiety that still needs to be treated by the medication, but by the very withdrawal from the medication. To some extent, it's a big mistake, I think, to treat anxiety with powerful benzodiazepine medications. So psychiatrists are hip to this, and they use less addictive medications called SSRIs. The original medication in that category was Prozac, but now there's Zoloft, Paxil, Lexapro, and a variety of newer formulations that they're actually antidepressant medications. But the notion is that, some people will say, well, I'm not depressed, I'm just anxious. Well, actually, from a biological standpoint, in terms of neurochemistry, the pathways are very similar. So if your patient is very classically depressed, if they just want to sit in a chair, turn off the lights, and, you know, are thinking suicidal thoughts, well, that's different than run-of-the-mill anxiety. Nonetheless, patients with anxiety often respond to SSRI medications, and occasionally I prescribe them. The problem with these medications is that a fairly high percentage of people just don't respond to these medications. And I recently learned that there's actually a gene that can be determined via simple saliva test. It's a test we perform called a genomine test that predicts one's likelihood of responding to anti-anxiety medications like the SSRIs. There's some people who have a gene that makes it unlikely that they'll get a good response, or that even they'll have an adverse response to these medications. They just won't feel well, or the medications won't do anything at all. And then there's the issue of, okay, you get on these medications, but they're not as addictive as the benzodiazepines, but there's something called Prozac backlash, which was originally described by a Harvard psychiatrist named Dr. Glenn Mullen. I believe it was in the 1990s that he first identified this syndrome, and it wasn't even realized that patients sometimes have a lot of trouble getting off SSRIs. They have terrible symptoms of withdrawal, anxiety, that makes it feel like they need to be on these medications. So it is possible with most categories of psychiatric medications to become dependent on them or to become physically addicted to these medications. And a lot of people also want to avoid the stigma of being on medication. You know, their medical records float around, and it's virtually impossible to conceal the fact that you are, quote, a mental case. You know, it's unfortunate that the stigma still exists. The vast majority of us suffer from depression or anxiety in one form or another at some point in life and may need help. But a lot of people are reluctant to get help because of the potential social stigma or perhaps some old-fashioned attitudes towards getting psychiatric help or acknowledging that they have a problem. Or the very real possibility that their medical record may be compromised. And the fact that they were under psychiatric treatment may be revealed. This actually has implications sometimes for gun owners, people who feel that they'd like to own firearms. If they're categorized as having a mental disorder, merely by virtue of the fact that they were on a drug at one point or another, this could be a very, very serious problem for them. So people trying to get into law enforcement, people trying to get into various types of jobs. So a lot of people, for that reason, don't get conventional psychiatric medications. Okay, then there's psychotherapy. And the problem with psychotherapy is that it can be a very long, drawn-out process. I sometimes cite to patients the very successful run for five seasons or so of The Sopranos. And Tony Soprano, very early in The Sopranos, experienced panic attacks. At first, he thought he was dying. He was having a heart attack. He fell to the floor gasping and lost control of his limbs and balance. But it turned out he was having panic attacks. Well, naturally enough, he was a guy with some very, very serious psychological issues, aggressiveness, and contained rage. And so then he went to see a psychiatrist. Well, that went very well with Dr. Melfi for five seasons, and perhaps thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of psychotherapy. But nonetheless, as was apparent by his continued murderous rages and general psychological maladaptation, the psychotherapy was not that effective for his anxiety disorders. A new form of psychotherapy has been introduced specifically to treat anxiety, which is such a pervasive problem in America, very high percentage, perhaps 20-30% of Americans suffer from one form of anxiety or another. And it's called CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And the aim of cognitive behavioral therapy, and I don't pretend to be a psychologist, or a psychiatrist is not so much to delve into your past. You know, in conventional psychiatry, as outlined originally by Freud in his classic writings, you know, you would go back into childhood and, you know, traumas and early adulthood and trace them. And, you know, it would take years and years to delve deeply enough to uncover and, in a way, exorcise these traumas, to bring them to the light of day and, in effect, purge them from the psyche of a patient suffering from fears and anxieties. In cognitive behavioral therapy, they don't so much care about, you know, the antecedents, the causes. They can touch upon them. But what they're really trying to do is they're trying to take kind of a philosophic or almost a Zen view towards anxiety, teaching patients that anxiety is merely a feeling. It is not real, that it is subject to internal neurochemical changes in the body that may sometimes signal that there's some upset, but that a person can learn various strategies to cope with these feelings and, as it were, overmaster them. And this is really has some relationship to Zen psychology, where in Zen Buddhism, the belief is that thoughts are very ephemeral, that they are not real unto themselves, and that through insight and meditation, we can pierce the veil of illusion of our thoughts and beliefs that sometimes lead us to maladaptive behaviors. So, I'm not going to go further into it, but cognitive behavioral therapy, usually short-term, a series of interventions, a teaching process. And also, it acknowledges that virtually any physiologic disturbance internally in the body can cause anxiety, because we are wired to want kind of a steady state. So if our bodies are under threat in any way, not necessarily through external factors, in the past it was fight or flight, you would run from danger. But in a modern setting, the danger is often less physical danger. It's perceived danger. It's thoughts that make us think that our boss is going to yell at us, fire us, disapprove us, or that we're going to receive approbation from our parents or our spouses or, you know, family, relatives, relationships. Or that we are going to be pursued by the IRS, or that we made a critical mistake at our jobs. These are beliefs, and we can develop a strategy for overmastering our wrong conviction that these beliefs assume a great deal of reality in our lives. You know, Mark Twain once said it beautifully. He said, "I've been through some terrible things in my life, and some of them actually happened." In other words, people have a lot of anticipatory anxiety, but the thoughts are illusory. Now, part of the problem is that some people are very, very geared to anxiety. They have a hereditary predisposition to anxiety, or they have a constitution which is nervous and anxious. I mean, I think you can see this from the dog world. There are dogs that are kind of lethargic and relaxed and sluggish. And then there are dogs which are sort of nervous dogs. Usually it goes along with dog size. You know, little dogs tend to be nervous and jumpy, and larger dogs are, you know, more chill. But people have constitutions in some ways like dogs, and there's a hereditary and constitutional aspect to that. There are also certain genetic characteristics that make people more anxious. And one of them that I look for is the condition of mitral valve prolapse. This is actually very important when I see patients, because I was seeing more and more patients with that form of heart murmur. And very early on, I recognized, and this is partly due to some important work by my good colleague, Dr. Leo Galland, who's investigated this condition, I became aware that patients with mitral valve prolapse were wired differently. They're much more sensitive to what's going on in their bodies. Some people are less attuned to what's going on below the neck, and some people are overly attuned. They perceive abnormalities in their heartbeat, you know, speed-ups, slowdowns, and skips, gastrointestinal changes, bloating, and so on. These are people who have visceral hyperattention, and as a result of their visceral hyperattention, they are overly sensitive. They may be overly sensitive to external sounds. They may be overly sensitive to criticism. They may be overly sensitive to the internal sensations that change inside their body. And so mitral valve prolapse is an important determinant of propensity to anxiety. And there, I've written some books on the subject of mitral valve prolapse that are both reassuring and also provide people with suggestions on how to cope with the anxiety that is associated with that. There's also a phenomenon that has been identified, which can, and some people think this is a oversimplification or is disrespectful of people who suffer from this syndrome, but we call it the weak and dizzy gene. And these are people who have postural orthostatic hypotension, or they have problems regulating their autonomic nervous system, and they seem overly sensitive to the production of adrenaline in their body. So when adrenaline is produced, they kind of overreact. And actually, there's a genetic basis for this. There's a physiologic basis for this. Their adrenaline receptors are more sensitive than other people. They have a what is sometimes called a weak and dizzy gene or a hyperexcitability gene, and they're easily thrown off their balance. Strategies that pertain to them. They need to maintain good hydration. We need to sometimes raise their blood pressure to keep them from suffering from bouts of low blood pressure, which are very disconcerting, causing dizziness and disorientation. This is one aspect of the physiologic perturbation of homeostasis that the body doesn't like. And the manifestation of you don't like where you are, you want to get out of there. And a fight-or-flight mechanism sometimes kicks in. The anxiety is actually a very, very primitive reflex. There are a couple of ways that animals respond to aggression. Sometimes we think, well, why does your hair stand on end when you're frightened? Well, it's actually a physiologic response that animals adapted so that they could look bigger. Your body hair, however, is pretty short, so you don't look much bigger when your hair stands on end. But if you are a wild animal and your hair stands on end, you can actually appear scarier and more formidable to an attacker. Another thing that happens, the heart rate goes up, blood circulation will increase so that you can prepare to run and flee from your attacker. You get a big shot of adrenaline, so you have more endurance. Unfortunately, in modern society, your attacker may often be someone who you have to not run from, but just listen to. Your attacker may be, a colleague at work, or a teacher, or a boss, and you've got to just take it, and you can't blow off the excess adrenaline that accumulates in your body when you're confronted by stress. It might be your mother-in-law or a relative. Similarly, another thing that happens is that animals literally pass out. They play dead. That's one of the reasons why syncope or fainting is actually a manifestation of panic attacks sometimes, because it's actually a defense mechanism, because when an animal that wants to eat you attacks you, one of the things that can dissuade that animal from thinking that you're edible is if you're dead. Some animals like to attack living animals, and if you faint and pass out and play possum, that's actually a term that's based on what possums do when they're attacked. They actually play dead. They play possum. And the attacker loses interest and walks away. Another way to dissuade an attacking animal from eating you is to soil yourself, to urinate or defecate, and thus create kind of an unappetizing meal. That is actually an accompaniment or accoutrement sometimes of anxiety. For some, excess need to urinate, or excess need to defecate, bowel urgency. They're very primitive reflexes, and this is part of our biology, and it's not our fault. We think we're rational beings, but we're actually wired for many, many centuries and millennia, and perhaps millions of years ago, and we have residues of a very ancient brain. So we're coping with these impulses. Anxiety is really quite natural. And, coming back to the subject of talk therapy, I am I'm very much a proponent of talk therapy for my patients with anxiety. I urge it. But one of the problems with our current medical system is that there's a great deal of incentivization for doctors to merely prescribe medications and not do detailed talk therapy. It's very cost ineffective to spend a lot of time talking to patients. I once talked to a psychiatrist colleague of mine at a cocktail party, and I said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Oh," he said, "much better," because I really thought I was going to have to go out of business. I was, seeing, 10 or 12 patients a day, and I wasn't able to charge very much, and I was exhausted talking to them. And so I hired a new office manager, and she revolutionized my practice. She streamlined it. And now I have appointments that last about anywhere from 8 to 12 minutes on average. I see 40 patients a day. I'm able to charge insurance companies and Medicare just as much as I used to for the 45-minute sessions that were so exhaustive with these patients. And I've moved much more to a medical model. I just prescribe medications, and sometimes it's very easy because a patient comes in, I say, "How are you doing?" "You're doing fine." And then I just re-prescribe the medication. I barely have to talk to the patient, so I can process a lot of patients through my office. Unfortunately, that's medical economics at work. This doctor is happier. I don't know if his patients are better off. He certainly doesn't spend that much time talking to them. And psychotherapists are very unhappy because they're not getting a lot of reimbursement. Plus, they're getting cut off. They want to work with patients long term to solve their problems, but they're told that they can only do 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 sessions, and then they're done. There's no more insurance available. So, I think talk therapy can be very effective, but unfortunately, it's not being used very much. So let's talk a little bit about some lifestyle factors. And then in part two, I'm going to talk about some specific supplements that are beneficial for anxiety. First of all, let's talk a little bit about exercise. Exercise can be very beneficial for anxiety, but there's a sort of a plus minus about exercise. If you go back to the legend of Pan is the mischievous Greek god, and the derivation of the word panic comes from Pan. And Pan used to be a mischievous Greek god who, in the olden days when people walked from one city-state to another, they had to traverse wildernesses and forests. There was a long distance between, say, Athens and Corinth and Sparta, so you'd have to travel lonely roads to get from one place to another. And Pan used to be a mischievous god who used to play tricks on travelers. He would hide in the bushes and then rustle the bushes, and then the traveler would hear some noises and speed up his or her pace. And Pan would run ahead and rustle the bushes some more. And pretty soon, the traveler was running in full-fledged panic because of Pan's mischievous tricks. Well, okay, exercise is a form of exertion that can normalize or stabilize the nervous system and prepare you for dealing with stress. But if your exercise is, sprinting and pounding the pavement, and if you're prone to stress, you can actually replicate in your body the same adrenalized state that is associated with panic. So for individuals who suffer from anxiety, I encourage moderate exercise up to their capacity, working up. But exercise alone is not necessarily a panacea. I guess that's a pun on words, for panic or for anxiety. It certainly has an antidepressant effect. It generates endorphins. But beware of exercise that's too adrenalizing, because then it just becomes part of your frenetic lifestyle. Lots of people need to slow down. Mind-body therapies can be very helpful. Yoga, acupuncture, meditation. Although for some people with severe anxiety, meditation is very hard. They're so anxious that their anxious thoughts just intrude on their meditative state. So sometimes that is not ideal for people with severe anxiety. The key to controlling anxiety to some extent is breathing, because breathing, if you do the proper voluntary breathing and learn to breathe diaphragmatically, with your abdominal muscles and not so much with your upper chest chest wall muscles, you can literally change your state. We can replicate anxiety by getting patients to hyperventilate. You know, just go, and you know that heavy breathing will change your CO2 oxygen balance, and you know, create a state of anxiety. So it was, you know, slow, methodical, controlled breathing, and teaching patients to make that natural, to something that they don't have to do voluntarily, but that they default to on a natural basis, can be a real key to handling severe anxiety. So these are part and parcel of our strategies. Diet is important too, because ups and downs of blood sugar are very, very impactful in terms of anxiety, particularly in patients with mitral valve prolapse or instability of their nervous system. Being hypoglycemic can literally create a panic attack. It starts a cascade of adrenaline production and cortisol production in your body. And so evening out blood sugar, and this may be through a lower carbohydrate diet or more frequent small snacks through the day, this can be very helpful in controlling anxiety. And of course, there's a lot of things that people consume dietarily that worsen anxiety. Lots of sugar, so many caffeinated beverages, also certain medications that contain decongestants. Not so much the antihistamines, but the decongestants have a speedy effect. You know, things like Red Bull that kids drink so prevalently. Alcohol intake. Well, alcohol initially relaxes you, but then there's a rebound hyper-excitation. Alcohol is terrible for anxiety. It's just short-term benefit, but long-term, it exacerbates anxiety. There's a couple of medical conditions that you have to look for in patients who report anxiety. One is hyperthyroidism. So if a patient who seems anxious and, you know, there's no clear-cut reason why, make sure that they don't have an overactive thyroid, because that will really get them to feel hyper-anxious. Their heart will race and so on. There's an adrenal condition called pheochromocytosis, where the body produces too much adrenaline. And it's a rare condition, but sometimes it is a cause of unremitting, difficult-to-treat anxiety. These are rare conditions. The vast majority of patients who have anxiety are just normal, anxious folks. And so we will now focus on some of the specific supplements and natural therapies that can be helpful for anxiety in part two. So stay tuned.